Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, Fred Obiero.
Hello, and welcome to the Ivy Podcast. My guest today is Benjamin DePoint, VP of Engineering at Veritone. How's it going, Benjamin?
Going pretty good, Fred.
People call you Benjamin or Ben? Which one do you prefer?
Benjamin is usually for when my wife's mad at me, so let's go with Ben.
That's a good one. All right. Before we start this episode, I have one small request to our listeners. As we continue to grow the Ivy Podcast, we would appreciate if you took just a minute of your time to leave us a review on the show, because reviews make a huge difference to podcast channels like ours. Now, time for the episode with Ben. So Ben, you have an extensive background around software engineering. Please tell us a bit about yourself and your background, and also briefly describe what Veritone does.
Sure. I've been in software engineering since 1998. I got into the industry really by the grace of God, because my background's in Asian history. I have a history degree with a focus on Asian history, but you know, you can't get a job with that. So when I got out of school, a buddy of mine got me an entry-level job at a digital imaging company. Uh-huh. From there, just through a few circumstances, I ended up getting into fixing software bugs. And that's where my career started off back in 98, working in some old tech Netscape Livewire. For any listener that knows what that is, congratulations.
I actually remember Netscape.
Yeah, inventors of JavaScript. From there, you know, I found out that I probably should have just went to school for that, because I realized that, it's actually a skill set that I had. Be creative, be logical. And it was just all these things that I had inside me, but I just never explored them in high school. So, you know, just thankful for that opportunity. From there, my career just went to various different industries. I've been in multi-level marketing. I've been in documents for Xerox. I've been in catering and the hospitality industry. Uh-huh. I've been in backup and disaster recovery with a company called Datto. Been in fintech, and now I'm in artificial intelligence space.
Wonderful. That's actually a good segue. So AI improvements are advancing at such a rapid pace. And just 2 weeks ago, we saw Tesla unveil what they call a humanoid robot prototype during their AI day. So two things that I'd like to discuss with you. The first one, has AI gone too far in some advancements, particularly when you view it from an ethical perspective, and how robots may in the future take over some of the things that humans do today?
You know, I don't think so. I think, you know, well, I mean, everyone has their own concept of ethics, right? But from my perspective, I think the types of activities that inventors and these startups that are building these humanoid robots or attempting to automate and leverage robots for are the types of things that it's hard to get humans to do nowadays anyway. You know, right. Some of them are focusing on military applications. Well, I think it's pretty ethical if you could have a robot conduct your war for you versus humans. You know, war is going to be with us. It's been with us at the dawn of time. So at the end of the day, if you can send a robot into battle to do whatever, police or whatever, and you could do that with the right set of fail safes and things of that nature, I think that's actually pretty ethical to spare human lives. As far as, you know, specifically the Tesla bot there, A, I think it needs some work. But B, like the idea of, you know, having it do remedial tasks around the office. They showed it in the video of watering plants, moving boxes, or, you know, even in some minor manufacturing applications. I think that those are all things that can be more efficient. And you know, the idea of having underskilled human labor is becoming a thing of the past. And right. So then the humans can focus on more of those, you know, those skilled things that you can't really build intelligence or artificial intelligence around at this point. You know, the engineering design aspects of what even goes into manufacturing, it goes into building out these robots, that's going to be continued to be done by humans. So I don't think it's gone too far. Could it? I could see some people with various, taking it too far, but I don't think we're there yet.
I want to follow up on something you said about, you know, the robots being used, you know, in war to protect lives, right? Because you don't want to have your troops be put in harm's way. And to some effect, that's already happening. I know the U.S. military deploys drones in the battlefield that are just hovering over the battle area and taking out targets. On the flip side, I actually didn't want to go into this topic, but since you opened the door, I'll walk right in, right? So assume the adversary in this case also has robots, or has the same equipment. Are we going to be in a situation where robots are going to war against robots? What do you think of that on a high level?
Yeah, I mean, I can foresee that. You know, then it becomes a matter of like who can produce and manufacture the robots faster.
Yeah,
you
the know, best technology.
Yeah, I mean, and you're right. War is a high-tech game now. There's I know companies that have been working on how to build smarter battlefields. And, right. You know, part of that is to, okay, can I predict troop movements? Can I predict targets where IEDs might be? And then shift troops from going into those areas. Or coordinating efforts across numerous sources, LIDAR, radar, body camera footage, and all that stuff, coordinating all of those activities so that I can make smarter decisions to save lives and be more targeted with my attack. You could, you know, extending that to having robots battling each other, same concepts apply. You know, you're just, right. You know, not killing humans, you're destroying, you know, machines.
That's true. I like that. What are some of the ways in which AI can be used by organizations to help them improve on their innovation projects and provide better services? Feel free to share any examples in general.
Yeah, I mean, we're already seeing it, right? So I was just thinking about this. You know, the advancements in call routing through voice prompts and natural language processing when I'm calling a call center. It's so ridiculous now. Like back in the day, you would have to wait in a queue, hit some buttons to go to a different queue, and you'd have these prompts. And if you screwed up, you have to hit another button to go back to the main menu. Now I'm just having a conversation with a bot that, you know, does a really good job of processing my natural language and then either answering questions for me and going finding the information or routing me to the right human to talk to. Those types of things, sure, we had approaches to solving them before we were using machine learning and AI to address it. But now it's just a better customer experience. And I think from a service perspective, that is way better for your customer. You know, same thing with chatbots. You know, it's hard to staff 24/7 some of these companies, 24/7 their support lines or the support chats. But right. You can do it with a bot. So now I'm getting better customer service because I can get the majority of my answers through a bot any time of the day. So if I'm up doing my bills late at night when no one's around, I can get the answers I need to a particular billing problem I have. I just think it's great from the product of service that you're providing people. As far as automating innovation, I was talking to a company recently. They're in the design space, the creative design space. And one of the things they're thinking about doing is how can they leverage machine learning to drive designs that are produced by their computer instead of having a creative do it for simple things. So based on the history of their design output, how can I learn from that? And then when I get some attributes of a upcoming request, have a computer produce this output for me and provide a quicker turnaround service for the end customer. Those types of things are awesome. It doesn't take away the humans that are involved.
No, it does not. It just makes it a more efficient process.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think those are some great examples. And even the company I work for now, we do some interesting things. You know, we're in the process of, let me step back. What Baritone does is we provide AI-enabled applications for customers that kind of offload their AI workloads. What that basically means is if a company doesn't or wants to leverage machine learning and AI, uh-huh. and doesn't want to build out that function on their own, they leverage us for some of our point solutions to. And what we do is we ingest their data, we process it against n number of cognitive categories, and we produce a result for them to take action on. Well, the process of doing the process of analyzing their data and producing uh-huh. result requires us to intelligently scale up and down compute and other resources in order to do that efficiently. Well, we're in the process of building out AI around that so we can do better there. So that's just a real practical example of where we can leverage AI to help us efficiently do the things that we're doing for our customers.
That's impressive. And to the extent that you can share, so are you guys based on like a public cloud environment, or is it something private where you, you know, have clients come in and you can process their data for them?
Actually, it's both. We deploy in our, we have a managed environment in all three of the major cloud carriers, GPC, Azure, and AWS. And we'll provide SaaS, a SaaS solution to our customers. But we also offer the ability to roll our solution on-prem or in your own managed cloud environment. So we have customers that do both deployment models.
That's good. That's good to know. And I think our listeners will find a lot of value in that, because not all companies can afford the resources of, you know, spinning up an AWS or GCP environment to like do their data processing for AI, because it requires a lot of bandwidth. And it's better to like have somebody else who's an expert at doing that, or a company that's an expert at doing that, to do that for you. So thanks for sharing that.
Yeah, right on.
You've been in your current role as the VP for several months now, and I was curious to know, how has the transition been like for you? What are some of the ways in which you prepared yourself for your current role that allowed you to settle in and start executing on key objectives with your team?
Yeah, that's a good question. So a little insider baseball here. I knew I was going to be a VP when I got hired. They just didn't bring me into that role right away. Uh-huh. So my whole first, 7 months at Veritone was kind of setting the stage for what that would look like. And okay. So I did a lot of groundwork, doing things like setting up a performance framework. And, you know, how do you rate engineers? You know, how do you make sure the team is performing, setting KPIs and things that are more strategic, and, you know, how we measure performance across teams, as well as doing things like the setting the job levels, explaining like what that career matrix looked like, and really capturing that and making that be a part of like the performance framework. And in there, I described the VP role, and in that VP role, I listed things that I was already doing that VP should do. But it was things that I was doing as a senior director. So I was preparing for that role along the way, knowing that it was coming.
Okay. Was there a VP, or was it a new position that basically you were assuming?
There was
like an ongoing person.
Yeah, there was a new, they created a new position for me.
Okay, good.
But you know, I had been a VP previously, so I have exposure to what that means and how that's distinguished between like a director role. Every context is different, right? Every company
right.
has intentions for what their role is. In some places, it's the lead architect. In some places, it's basically the guy that started with the startup that knows the most about the software and you know, doesn't really deal with the humans. For me, it's always been operationalizing an engineering effort. That's really where I played the majority of my leadership role, is how do I take engineering teams, operationalize them, make sure the day-to-day is smooth, and get the most out of them.
That's good. And this is important, because the reason I was asking this question is there's a lot of people that are taking on new positions, switching companies, and you always want to get a behind the scenes look of how people prepare to assume these roles, because the first 30, 60, 90 days, those are the crucial moments for any new hire. It could be a VP level, it could be a low level. And it's important for people to understand what goes into the planning and preparation before people assume such high level positions. And I'm happy that you were willing to like go into detail about how you assume that position, because it will help a lot of people, even me in my future, if I wanted to like assume a different role.
Yeah, you know, like, let me go into that a little bit more, because you're right. Those transition periods are make or break, right?
Yeah.
And so one of the things, and I did a lot of reading on this when I was getting my MBA, but one of the things that is critical is making sure you are aligned with your manager and your leadership, and, mm-hmm. and being very direct. Like, what is it that equals success for you? One of the things that I think people in a subordinate role should always do is try to help their boss be the best that they can be.
Yep.
You know, you want to optimize around delivering value for your boss that allows them to do their job easier. And so when you start a new endeavor and you're going into a new role up front, even in the recruiting process, even, you know, through the interview process, you start asking the questions, what does success look like in 30, 60, 90? You know, what are the key things that you're going to measure me against? against.
Right.
And when you find things that there's gaps between what you offer and what they want, you have open conversations about them. You know, hey, I don't particularly have the skill set, but you know, I enjoy stretching myself and learning those skills. And you know, you're making sure that you're being completely open with what they're getting so that they can be open with what they expect.
Yeah. And you're also showing that you're willing to learn more, because we all, you know, it's continuous learning life for everybody, regardless of what role you occupy.
Right on. Yeah, exactly.
We're currently going through a phase in the economy where the unemployment rate is very low, especially in the software engineering field. What are some of the things that you are particularly doing to attract the best talent, also retain, to your teams for open positions?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's been really competitive, right? So it's slowing down a little bit considering the macroeconomic environment. But for the first year or so while I was at Veritone, it just competition for engineering was hard. So the first thing that you want to try to do, if you can do it, is make sure that money is not an issue. Mm-hmm. Meaning if you can stay above 80, 85 percentile in your hiring, cool. That makes that really easy. And then you want to have, you know, like a solid benefits package if there's equity involved or whatever. But that's kind of table stakes. You want to get that up front. The next thing is making sure that there is actually a vision for what the role is. You know, if someone comes onto a team, or they're talking to people throughout the interview process, and it's not consistent about what this role is going to be doing, it leaves like an uneasy feeling in people's in people's mind, because they want to know that they're coming in and they're going to have like purpose for what they're doing. So you want to create purpose, and you want to have challenging environments or challenging opportunities, stretch opportunities for people. So what we try to do is really highlight the difficulties or the challenges that we have every day that we're trying to solve, and how we culturally, how we want everyone contributing to that, not just being a code monkey following the direction of some, you know, director or VP or whatever, but actually bringing your creativity and all the skills and experiences that you've had to the table and sharing them with the team and helping us solve those problems. And I think that presenting those challenges and having the money and the benefits package right addresses both sides, the intrinsic motivators and then those external ones that, you know, everyone has to have.
Speaking of one, and sort of cut you off here before I forget this aspect, we're seeing a lot of companies, you know, experience this problem, if I can call it a problem, where a lot of the job applicants want to be fully remote. What's your take on the people that want to be fully remote? Do you see that being the future trend in the workplace environment? Or do you see people going back to the pre-pandemic days where everybody's suspected in the office from 9 to 5, Monday through Friday?
Yeah, so Veritone is a fully remote company. But we do have some collab space in two cities where people want to go into the office, they can. So my opinion on fully remote is it's about time. It's thought work. Especially for software engineering. It's thought you don't have to be around other people to do it well. But I think companies need to make space for people that do want to interact and do want to socialize. Personally, I've never been a big, like, hey, let me hang out with all my work buddies person. This is not my personality.
People are different.
Yeah. But there's some people that need that. They thrive on that. So I think that this hybrid approach that you're seeing more of, where people can go in or not, where people can, move to a location where there is an office, or they can stay in their remote location where it's just more convenient for their family. I think it's smart, because what you're doing is you're not limiting yourself to a geographical location for finding the best engineers. You're opening it up to at least your country, maybe multiple countries, to find the best talent to help you with your business goals. Now, the downside of it is you can get you run the risk of, especially in the way that I believe you should build software, which is complete collaboration through teams, you run the risk of like limiting those interactions interactions, having less collaboration. So you have to guard against that.
Being able to drive change in an organization is one of the main aspects that separates good leaders from the rest of the pack. What qualities do you believe make for better leadership skills when it comes to leading a strong team of engineers at any company?
Oh man, I can tell you. So the beginning of my career was filled with bad leadership. Like, I learned and I desired to get into leadership because, man, that guy was bad. This person was bad. And that person was bad. And it's not like from the standpoint of like, I knew better. I just knew what bad looked like.
Yeah.
And so I think one of the hallmarks of bad is the person that needs to be involved in everything. They think they need to be involved in every little detail in their personality. Yeah. And I don't even know if I would necessarily call it micromanaging, but they think they have to be present and have an opinion on everything that's going on in an organization.
Right.
And when they come into the room, they're the center of attention. To me, that is like the opposite of servant leadership. And I'm not, when people say servant leadership, they often think like, well, I'm just kind of aloof over here in the corner and I'll just do, you know, I'll support you whatever you ask me. That's not what I mean. I think leaders should have opinions. They need to present vision. They need to show the team and the company what the future can look like. And they need to organize the teams within their care to muster around that goal and keep them on track when they're off and things of that nature. But you do it in a way where you're helping them as they're working towards that vision. So, for example, you know, if part of the vision is blocking and tackling and moving roadblocks between your group and another group, you don't have to, that's where you jump in. You let the engineers do the hard stuff and you kind of grease the wheels, so to speak, to get that friction out of the way between you and this other group to accomplish your goal. You're willing and open to do whatever it takes to get them to be as successful as they can be to meet their goals. I think it's a combination of humility, being trustworthy, having integrity and being honest, admitting when you're wrong. Like there's plenty of times where I've had a vision and then I thought tactically how to get there. And then we find out a few weeks or months down the road that my tactic was completely wrong. In fact, I just did this the other day. I was, I have a clear view of how I want to present data for how the teams are working so that I can share with the business and other stakeholders around the company about our success. And I was being really anal about one thing that I wanted. And after thinking about it and getting pushback from people that I support directly, I realized like actually the thing I was asking for was completely wrong. So I apologized to the team, said what I was asking for is wrong, but what Tony was asking for was correct. That's the way we should go.
And that's good self-awareness.
Yeah, I think when you do that, or not that specifically, but when you have those that type of humility and that type of like said self-awareness, I think people gravitate towards that, and that's what I look for in my leadership. I want that out of my leadership. I don't want bravado say that word right. what am I trying to say? You know, people with a lot of gusto and charisma, like that's cool, but that doesn't make me want to follow you. What makes me want to follow you is when I believe you have my back. When I believe you self-analyze and recognize when you're wrong, those things are the things that I think are doing.
You said a lot of important things there, but to me, one of the ones that really stands out is the one you started with, which is you've had bad managers. You another time, especially when you were younger, you didn't know, you didn't have that experience, but you know what a good manager is and what a bad manager is, right? I think that's very crucial.
Yeah, you can kind of feel it, right?
Yeah.
You know, when you're sitting there going, why am I doing this? This should be this guy, you know, this person.
Yeah.
You're like, you start to connect the dots. Like, oh, you mean the person that, you know, kind of didn't show leadership in a crisis, that kind of disappeared and they weren't able to be found? Like, that tells you something's wrong there. Someone should step up and show leadership in a crisis. You know, be calming, stabilizing, not here on fire. You know, you don't want your leaders to be all excitable and everything's on fire. Everything's like crazy. And then everyone else below you starts going crazy and they don't know what to focus and focus on.
You know that saying, if the general panics, the troops will panic.
Right, exactly.
That's exactly what happens. And for our young listeners, this is important. No, you know, you're not born with the skills. You may not have that experience leading a company or a team. But just like Ben is saying here, you can see what a good leader is and you can sense what bad leadership looks like. It doesn't mean you have to follow what a bad leader is doing, but it's important to understand what makes a good leader and what makes a bad leader, especially if you want to go into those leadership roles. Now, Ben, I want to transition to the last question, which again is very important to people, especially some of our young listeners who may want to grow and become someone like you or go on to like, you know, large companies. And even for those that have gone, you know, a similar path to yours and they just want to see how you got to where you are and how they, you know, compare to their own trajectory. So what has helped you to get where you are and what advice would you give to someone that wants to pursue a career that's identical to yours?
Yeah, so my career being a non-traditional way I got into it is a little unique, but what I will say is the thing that really took me to another level from a leadership standpoint is when I actually decided to spend the amount of effort in that craft as I did as becoming a software engineer. So a lot of times what happens is software engineers, you know, you become a strong doer and someone's like, oh, you should lead. And then they just kind of go about it, you know, whatever way they think of. And you know, they just kind of trial and error or don't even put much effort and thought in this user personality. Well, I think you have to use the same amount or put in the same amount of hard work to become a good leader as you did to become a software engineer. So I think that's the first thing, whether it's formal education or just getting mentors or, you know, just signing up for, you know, different certifications, watching, you know, videos, reading articles on HBR, things like that. You have to put in the work to develop that craft. And then when you get into it, you have to get into it for the right reasons. I got into it for the wrong reasons. I had a young family. I was a good doer. An opportunity came up to be, and it came up to be a manager. I'm going to do that because I'm going to make more money. Like that was what it was like in the early 2000s was the best doers became managers. And that was the only path you could follow to make more money. Well, thankfully the industry shifted where you could be in an IC pack or IC track and make more money than your manager, which is, I think, awesome. This whole antiquated notion that the manager needs to make more money than people that are supporting is just bizarre. And so I think you need to get into it for the right reasons. And that would be you find value or you think that or you find enjoyment or fulfillment in helping other people achieve their goals and working through other people to achieve company goals. Like if that's a motivator for you, then you should consider getting into leadership. If it's not, and it's really just title, power, money, you're doing the wrong thing. It's not helping any. It's not helping the company. It's not helping the people that you would be supporting. And ultimately, it doesn't help. So I think you need to have that right frame of mind for when you want to get leadership. And I think the other thing is you have to figure out how to enhance your emotional intelligence. You know, you need to become self-aware. You need [S2] Right. [S1] To be regulated. You need to have good social interaction skills. That doesn't mean you have to be, you know, fake and talk about things you don't really care about. But how do you relate to people? How can you get in with Jack Welch, a guy I've done a lot of reading on? How do you get into everyone's skin? How do you understand where they are? And how do you get the best out of them to so that they can pour into your team, to your company's success?
Good. Well, Ben, this has been a wonderful conversation. Thanks a lot for being with us today.
Hey, Fred, I appreciate it, man. Anytime.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Ivy Podcast. Please take a moment to rate, review, and subscribe on your preferred podcast listening platform. We really appreciate that effort. Until next time.